Mr. Shrug.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. We are, I think, in this case entirely in the statutory realm. And I think if any body of law is one in which the Supreme Court has made clear that it will rely on this relatively recently passed statute on the wording of the statute to say what it means, rather than looking to larger issues of policy that others may find ought to be advanced by it, this is one. And so the question becomes, in this case, what do 362A6 and 524A2 mean when they prohibit, at various times in the course of a bankruptcy case, an act by a creditor to collect on a pre-petition or a pre-discharge debt? And I guess there are two ways. We could turn directly to the statute. But I submit, first of all, and although I've said this in our opening brief, said it since, neither the debtor nor amicus has responded to the argument that this case is, in fact, ruled by a holding of a U.S. Supreme Court case in Ray Strumpf.
I don't find Strumpf to be quite the slam dunk that you do, actually, because the Court's opinion in Strumpf is dealing with a temporary hold on a bank account, which is in the nature of preserving assets for the estate, which the bankruptcy court at the end of that temporary hold would either say the bank was entitled to set off against the loan that the debtor owned there, or perhaps the bankruptcy court might have thought that those assets should be thrown into the pool with everything else. Would have been up to the court. But the opinion of the court in that case really is looking at quite a different circumstance than your case, which is not about preserving assets for an estate, and certainly isn't temporary.
Your Honor, if I may, I think our case is a stronger case for the application.
I'm not sure. I know you have this alternative holding of Strumpf as part of your theory, but
it is what the court. It is what the court said. Obviously, much of Strumpf turns on 362A7.
All of Strumpf is influenced by the context of the case, and it's again even the last sentence of the part that you're looking at.
Right.
Petitioner's temporary refusal to pay was neither a taking of possession of respondent's property nor an exercising of control over it, merely a refusal to perform its promise, but it was a temporary refusal. And I don't think it's fair to Supreme Court opinions to pick, three or four words out of context and hang your hat on them.
Well, with respect, Judge Wood, this was an alternative argument that the appellant made, petitioner made, in the Strumpf case, a few sentences up from where you read. Respondent's reliance rests on the false premise that petitioner's administrative hold, which is what we did here, took something from respondent or exercised dominion over property that belonged to the respondent.
But that's just about banks. I mean, bank accounts and I just have to say, part of your theory also is that this transcript is somehow a piece of property. And I guess in that respect, my marriage license is a piece of property and a death certificate of somebody who died, as opposed to simply being evidence of the fact that something happened. If you go get a birth certificate, that's evidence that a birth happened. And this transcript could be viewed simply as evidence that courses were taken at a particular university, completed as they were completed.
Your Honor, if I could answer the first question first and the second. I think that the Strumpf case is actually applies more strongly here than it did in Strumpf itself, because while it was necessarily temporary in that case, because the bank did in fact owe the debtor money in Strumpf, the checking account was in fact a debt owed that would eventually have to be settled up. Here, the college, the university, does not owe the debtor anything.
Let me ask you this question. Can you articulate for me, which you have not done in your briefs, at least one purpose that the university has for not releasing this transcript that has nothing to do with collection of money from the debtor for the unpaid tuition?
This debtor will...
One purpose. Please answer the question.
It has at least one purpose, and that is if it does not have to provide a transcript as a general proposition, to students who do not pay their...
See, you're back to money.
No, I am back to money, and I'm going to answer the question.
So, in other words, you're answering me that there is, in fact, no purpose unrelated to the collection of tuition.
Well, there may be a moral purpose. We haven't argued that. But there,
you haven't argued that. And I guess what concerns me is, you know, she's willing to pay the $10 or whatever it is, you know, the document fee. This case isn't about that. So whatever time it takes for somebody to type something into a computer and hit a print button and put a stamp on it, use the right kind of paper, whatever it is you do, that's compensated.
Your Honor, this case is all about what the law is.
No, this case is all about are you taking an act to collect a debt? Because I'd like to go back to your first point. I'd like to go back to the language of 362A6, since you seem to want to insert a word into the statute, which would be an injunction against an affirmative act to collect, recover, et cetera. And I don't know where the insertion comes from if you're going to be a plain language person.
Nobody approached the debtor and asked for anything. The debtor began this dialogue.
But you took an act. Somebody was instructed to put a hold, for example, on that transcript.
The hold had been on the transcript for 2 years
before
the bankruptcy
was filed.
Correct. So
that's an act. Why isn't that an act?
Well, because the code does not prescribe pre-filing acts.
But the act was repeated each time she asked for the transcript.
Each time she initiated contact, she was told, no, we will not give you a transcript.
And why isn't that an act?
Because it isn't. It is a declination to provide something that's been asked for under circumstances.
You're playing with words.
Your Honor, it isn't. And it gets back to this point, if I may, with all respect. It gets back to the point of whether or not the university is obliged to do it. If the university isn't obliged to do it, then debtors getting good advice, as this debtor didn't, will know that they have to deal with that.
Of
that
course,
transcript
the result
is important.
Of the, yeah.
We might
no.
have had a reaffirmation agreement. This might have been
of
like
course.
Duke.
I understand all of that. And in the future, if you win, universities will continue to do these installment payment plans, and universities won't give transcripts, and people just have to take the courses all over again if they didn't do it. If you lose, then you probably will stop that program, and you will give people student loans that are non-dischargeable, and you will do other things that will protect your financial interest. Of course, cases have consequences. But the question right now is, have you, at the moment, under the law as it now stands, taken an act to recover a debt? And you've said there is no other reason for your transcript policy other than to collect the money.
There is no reason for the policy in general, which is applied uniformly. There has never been an effort. And the testimony in this case was that there were no circumstances under which Ms. Keene would be provided with a transcript. That
right, so you give transcripts to felons, you give transcripts to all sorts of other people as long as they pay.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that is the answer, that if there is a right, then we ought to be told that there is a right.
How does this work for other institutions? Parties have pretty much limited their discussion to universities and what bankruptcy appellate panels have said about universities. But this problem seems to me the same in principle as any other vendor. Let's suppose a vendor of shoes to Kmart, a recently conspicuous debtor, has the rule that as long as any of Kmart's debt is unpaid, it won't sell any new shoes to Kmart. Is that, in your view, an action to collect? And the vendor says, the only reason we're doing this is because we have a policy that we never sell shoes to people who haven't paid us in full.
No more so, Your Honor, than a bank refusing to lend new money to somebody who hasn't paid the last debt.
So that's your view. You're consistent. Do we know, have questions like that been litigated? What's the outcome of that case?
I don't know that anybody has litigated that question. The argument seems to be that there's something unique about transcripts. I agree with you that the legal principle...
There's nothing in the statute about transcripts,
right.
So I'm trying to get a broader perspective.
Right.
So I'm trying to figure out what happens if the vendor of shoes says, in order to get people to pay us, we stop dealing with them when they enter into bankruptcy. We won't sell them new shoes, even if they pay the price. That has to have been litigated. That has to be the same kind of question as this?
I think it is the same kind of question. I don't know that it has been litigated. I don't know that any debtor would have the temerity to make the argument.
I can't believe that that hasn't been litigated.
I can't believe it either, but I would like to change the hypothetical a little bit. What if, in fact, the debtor simply says, I need a receipt from you, Kmart, that verifies that I ordered the last shipment of shoes before the bankruptcy, mm-hmm. and Kmart says, we won't even give you the receipt. So somebody else might think it was a shipment of stolen goods, or it was, yeah.
But where does
so
the
for
obli-
some reason you need the receipt.
Where does the obligation come from? It either comes from state law, and it doesn't here, and the district court was clear on that. There is no obligation.
But where does it
come from under 524? It is not an act to collect from this debtor. It may be a part
I'm
of a policy.
But what I'm asking is
that's right.
The reason I'm trying to get to the receipt is it strikes me as a little closer to evidence of a prior transaction mm-hmm. as opposed to Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical where it's an ongoing transaction. Now, one of the cases the parties cited, which isn't our case, so we don't have to decide it, was the Boston University situation where new classes had to be taken. That, I think, is an absolute match to Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical.
Well, I do, too. But
you aren't there. She's not trying to take any more classes
from you.
Well,
apparently not. But if she were, she cites that case as persuasive.
And maybe you could say, no, that would be our – well, and we may think it's analogous or we may not. It's a bankruptcy court case.
Well, I understand. Excuse me, Your Honor, for speeding over you. But if the motivation to collect a debt is all that brings it within 524, mm-hmm. then it seems to me there is no limit to that,
well,
because creditors always want to collect debts.
Well,
I mean, that's always in the background of commercial relationships. But there was no effort to collect the debt here.
Let's ask this question in a different way. Let's go back to state law. What would happen under state law if the university said, we've decided to raise our price for undergraduate education. We actually sold you the education for too little. Mm-hmm. So now, in order to get a transcript, you have to pay $5,000 because that plus what you actually paid for the education is an approximation of the real cost. Would that be valid under state law?
No, I don't think so. I think the contract entered into. What do you mean, after the fact?
Now you see my problem. Now you're saying that the contract to buy the education as a matter of state law entitled the buyer to a transcript without additional payment.
Well, there is a small payment.
Yeah, well, a fee for keeping records.
Right.
But if, as a matter of state law, the university could not set a fee other than a nominal one for the transcript, then it sounds like the information is already in some sense a property of the debtor rather than of the university.
No, I don't mean to say that the college couldn't have ab initio set the fee at a higher rate.
No, but
I'm
Judge Easterbrook's question gets... Judge Easterbrook's question gets at the point, is this still an open transaction? If the person hasn't really finished yet until the transcript is tendered, then what's to prevent the university from saying another $5,000 is due?
I don't think it's an open transaction because it's been breached. It's certainly not executory under the rules.
So you agree it's not executory. You agree that...
The debtor's breach excuses performance by the university.
But the university already performed in terms of giving the classes, in terms of letting her graduate, in terms of conferring the degree. The only thing the university hasn't done is give her the evidence that that happened.
It has not provided a transcript, as it said ahead of time that it wouldn't do if bills weren't paid. Your Honor, I'm trenching on my rebuttal time, and if I may, I'd like to reserve whatever's
Certainly.
Left.
Certainly, Mr. Schreiner. Ms. Hamill.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Patricia Hamill. I represent the debtor and appellee in this case, Stephanie Keene. And the sole issue in this case is whether holding transcripts for nonpayment of tuition during the former student's bankruptcy case and following the discharge violates the bankruptcy code. And the district court, we prefer, correctly found that it did. assessed damages, or affirmed the finding of the bankruptcy court that this was a violation of the bankruptcy stay and discharge, assessing damages against Cardinal Stritch for the lost income that the debtor suffered due to her inability to obtain her transcripts for over 3 years.
You're referring to Cardinal Stritch University, Cardinal Stritch no longer being available.
Yes. Yeah, I'm referring to the university. I stand corrected. The purpose of the stay in bankruptcy is to promote orderly liquidation or effective reorganization of the debtor. It's a fundamental protection afforded to debtors in bankruptcy.
Now, Ms. Hamill, this case strikes me as odd in the following sense. It reminds me of the old saying, be careful what you wish for, although I realize for your client what she would like is the transcript. But it seems to me that Cardinal Stritch University in the end would be punished almost by what was a relatively generous policy of allowing installment payments for tuition. Why wouldn't every university, if you win, simply say, we're going to structure financial assistance by giving you a loan and then you pay it back to us because those loans are non-dischargeable? Here they are, and they may discover that this debt of $6,000 and some, which was, of course, discharged in the bankruptcy, now has also changed what its policy would have been about releasing transcripts.
I don't know, Your Honor, what the current policy of Cardinal Stritch is with regard to payment of tuition.
I assume, again, you mean the university?
I'm sorry, I will try to use that language. However, I think that many universities probably already have a position that if a student completes a semester and does not pay tuition for the following semester, they're going to have to take out a loan or they're not going to be allowed to re-enroll.
Well, it's a pretty standard position as far as my anecdotal knowledge is that universities don't let you register for classes until you regularize things financially. Now, the bankruptcy law then comes in on top of all of these normal arrangements, and that's what our problem is.
And that's precisely the issue here, I think, is that whatever Cardinal Stritch's rights may have been pursuant to the contract that they had with the debtor, those rights are subsumed under the policies of the federal bankruptcy law, which allow the debtor to discharge this debt and protect the debtor from collection activity, including any act to collect, assess, or recover the debt.
Now, do you think that this is still an executory arrangement between the university and Ms. Keene, she pronounces it?
Keene, yes.
Keene?
And I agree.
Or is this completed?
I agree with the interpretation of the district court that this transaction is essentially completed. This is not the same as selling shoes or widgets or a piece of tangible property. A transcript, I don't believe it is property.
In what way is the transaction completed? Let's work through this in steps. Suppose that Ms. Keene enrolls in the university at the beginning of a semester, doesn't pay the tuition, and goes through 7 weeks, half the semester, and gets a discharge in bankruptcy. Does the university have to allow her to take the next 7 weeks of classes for free?
Well, that's not an issue that's before us here.
I
don't think the university was required to permit her to enroll for the last year and a half that she attended.
No. Would you answer my question? I'm trying to deal with somebody who signs up for a semester of education, agrees to pay X dollars, gets a discharge halfway through, and then shows up and says, I want the rest of the education. And the university says, no, we haven't been paid. We're not going to deliver any more education.
Well, I think
does
at that
it have
point,
to do that?
That's not the case we have before it, but
I'm
I think
well
in that
aware
case
of that, counsel.
That the university would be entitled to something like adequate protection to require that the debtor
it's
pay.
Not a security interest case.
No, I agree that it's not.
Does the university is a vendor of education. If it delivers half and isn't paid, does it have to deliver the other half? I assume your answer, if it's not a university, but it's U.S. Steel, and it agrees to deliver 2 tons of steel, and after it's delivered the first ton of steel, the buyer declares bankruptcy, the U.S. Steel doesn't have to deliver the second ton of steel unless it's paid for the steel. Now, it's got to be the same for a university education. All right, now, suppose bankruptcy is declared at the end of the semester before the exam is taken. does the university have to allow the student to sit for the exam and deliver a grade? Seems to me the same question.
Right. My opinion,
well,
no.
And now, now the grade has been, the exam has been sat and the grade has been given. Does the university have to deliver the grade? That seems to be the question here. And I'm trying to figure out in what way it is different from the delivering the last 7 weeks of education or sitting for the examination and grading the paper and so on. Is it different?
I don't think so, and I think the university has its contract rights outside of bankruptcy.
If you say it's not different, counsel, then you're, I think, then you're saying the university wins.
Yeah, I think what you, what we're looking for here is a line, and actually I think the first part of this line means that you have essentially said you are not relying on In re Kathleen Parker, the Massachusetts case I mentioned a minute ago. Now, the line could be in the middle of classes you have to give more. The line could be classes are done for the exam. In this case, your line, I had thought, was the fact that the university actually took the step of graduating her.
Correct.
You know, went so far as to say your education is finished. And if that is a rational line, then that's what one thing that would distinguish your case from some of these hypotheticals. It may not be a rational line. I mean, you know, you have to ask at what point has the university itself performed so much in light of this nonpayment that it has, if you will, forgiven the failure to pay the tuition and simply completed the transaction.
And I think this transaction was completed. The contract between the debtor and the university was for the provision of an education. It required something more than payment of money. It required the student to attend the classes and the university to provide the education, including the classwork, course materials, and examinations.
And all of that happened, and the
all
university,
of it happened.
In fact, conferred a degree.
Correct.
On Ms. Keene. And I take it your opponent agrees that this is not an executory contract as well. So there may not even be any dispute between you on this point.
I don't think there is a dispute on that point, and I think that absent the bankruptcy filing, the university would be entitled to withhold her transcripts, her library privileges, and everything else that's included in the contract that they entered into, which clearly provided and was restated by the appellant numerous times. You don't give this unless you pay.
But now I'm puzzled. And if the student signs up at the beginning of the semester, the beginning of a career, agrees to pay. It's executory until the university has completed its performance. And it's pretty much standard policy in bankruptcy, it's standard in bankruptcy law, that if the debtor wants to assume an executory contract, that's certainly permissible. But in order to do that, the debtor has to pay. If the contract is executory with respect to the delivery of the last 7 weeks of the semester or the grading of the exam or the issuance of a degree, why is it not executory with respect to the delivery of a transcript? And your argument is, if I had understood it correctly, that there was this contract in which the university had certain duties. It had to deliver the education. It had to deliver the degree. If the student passed, it has to deliver the credential, the evidence that that's happened. And all these duties are future duties. They're executory. But then why isn't it subject to the rule of bankruptcy law that for the debtor to force the other side to keep the rest of the executory contract, the debtor has to reaffirm and pay?
Because that's contrary to the discharge. And if you look at the Pratt decision out of the First Circuit from 2006.
I'm lost. I thought you agreed with me that the university doesn't have to deliver the last 7 weeks of education in a semester, that that's executory.
Correct.
So why is this executory part of the contract, the delivery of the transcript, any different from the delivery of 7 weeks of education or the grading of an exam or the handing over of a degree?
Because it's simply a record of the education that was obtained, of the work that was done, of the education that was provided.
And you're saying she's willing to pay for that record.
She is willing to pay for that record. She offered to pay for it. And she was told repeatedly, you will not get your transcript until you pay. So the university has characterized this as a promise, failure to perform on a promise, looking at the Billingsley bankruptcy case from New Jersey.
Yeah,
I think it's more of a threat.
Look, I hope you see the problem. Why is it any different from the university saying you won't get to attend class for the last 7 weeks of this semester unless you pay for the whole semester? That is, unless you reaffirm and pay the whole executory contract.
It's different because there's a federal policy under the bankruptcy code.
No, it's the same federal policy that applies, right? I'm trying to see why there is a difference between the last 7 weeks of a semester and the transcript. You can't say the difference is that there is this federal discharge policy. That's the same with respect to both. Now, there may be a difference, but it can't be that there is this federal policy.
Well, state law rights matter, but federal law matters more. The Butner case under the Supreme Court made it clear that state rights govern unless federal interests require a different result. And here we have a federal interest of the fresh start in bankruptcy. The contract was completed. All that remained was the provision of a transcript.
Look, I'll ask this one more time and give up. Why wouldn't you be saying the very same thing, then, if I asked you about the last 7 weeks of the semester? Why wouldn't you be saying, my client has gotten a discharge, all that remains is the delivery of 7 more weeks of education? You wouldn't say that because
the contract was not completed.
The contract is executory for that period.
It's not executory. It was completed.
But that's where you're losing me, I think. The student makes a payment, and then the university's got a bunch of duties. It has to allow the student to take classes. It has to set and grade examinations. It has to deliver a degree. And finally, it has to deliver a transcript. All of those look like future duties on an executory contract. Until the last one has been performed, it's still executory. What am I missing?
The provision of the transcript is not a part of the executory contract. It's just a record of the fact that the student completed the education. It doesn't cost the university anything to provide a transcript.
Maybe what you the other thing about transcripts, I think, is it's a perpetual duty. You know, people who apply to graduate school later have to get one. 10 years later, maybe you're applying for a job in a school district. 15 years later, maybe you're filling out a FBI full field security clearance form, and you need a you need transcripts forever. So perhaps these contracts are executory forever, if it's really executory, or perhaps the first contract is over with, and then the minor contract will give you transcripts when needed for payment of appropriate administrative fees is a new one that takes over.
And I would submit that the district court correctly characterized this as a receipt or a record of the completed contract, and the coercive nature of the university's withholding of that transcript is self-evident. She cannot obtain the transcript anywhere else.
There are two possibilities. One, which Judge Wood has suggested, is that after the bankruptcy is over, the debtor proposes to form a new contract with the university for a transcript, because the university has data. Now, if the debtor already owns the data in some sense, then I assume the university has to turn over the data, has to have evidence of the data. The other possibility is that this is a duty that the university had under its contract to educate the debtor. And then it sounds executory. Well, how do we know which of these it is as a matter of state law?
Well, state law is silent on the issue of transcripts except as to public records, and state law no longer controls because the intervening bankruptcy.
Let me ask you the question I asked Mr. Schreiner. I assume, no, I don't want to assume anything. Suppose the university says, you know, your client, forget bankruptcy law. The university says our student has got a really attractive offer. It's going to make her $1 million a year. We've decided to charge $5,000 for the transcript before your client goes off to become the CEO of a big firm, because, after all, we furnish the education for less than its price, and this is an opportunity to share in our student's success. We're going to charge $5,000 or $10,000 for the transcript. As a matter of state law, could it do that?
I don't know. I don't see why not, because I think they've not established a price for a transcript in the contract, whatever contract there was, and it wasn't even clear in this case what the contract was, except that there was an installment tuition arrangement.
You see, if you think the university can charge $5,000 or $10,000 for the contract, I think you're now saying that the data are not data that are owned by the debtor. They're data owned by the university, which you can exploit in its economic interest. And if that's so, then we're back to my example of the manufacturer of shoes choosing not to sell to Kmart. It's using its economic advantage to try to improve itself.
And I don't think
Are there other laws that bear on this?
What's odd to me is that both sides have given answers to my question that favor the other side.
They have. It's a very odd thing, and I'm wondering if there are other laws that bear on this, such as the laws regulating the university's right to release academic information to third parties. There are, in fact, laws in that area that might tend to give you some legal basis for deciding whose data this is. But I think maybe I should. Yeah.
There's the Family Educational Rights Privacy Act that allows students and their families to review educational records and to correct any inaccuracies. But I don't think there's any.
That's not the question. The question is. Another way to put this question is, could the university sell your client's transcript to, let's say, NBC, which decided that it wants to put it on a TV show for some purpose? Could the university sell your client's transcript to NBC?
Well, I think that would be a violation of the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act.
Right.
So
maybe that suggests that your client owns the data already.
Which would make it favorable.
The client has some right of access to it. It's similar to a medical record, and that further points out why the Strumpf analogy is inaccurate, inapposite in this case, because that involved a right to set off, where the creditor could liquidate the bank account and apply it to the debt, and a transcript is not anything that has any value to the creditor, which is why the court rejected the contract analysis and found that this was a violation of the bankruptcy statute.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Schreiner?
Just, Your Honor, that we have litigated this case on the assumption, never contested, that state law does not accord Ms. Keene the opportunity to compel the university to provide the transcript.
Would state law allow the university to sell the transcript to NBC?
I think it might, were it not for the imposition of the federal act that regulates, as Congress has the authority to do, the treatment of student records. But to get back to your earlier question, and if it troubles you that I'm giving an answer that doesn't appear to work in my interest,
no,
I guess I have to leave that.
I'm delighted when lawyers give answers that don't work in their clients' interests. It suggests they're being honest. But the problem is that each side has honestly answered in the other side's favor.
It does happen occasionally.
It's a problem.
It does happen occasionally. The reason I think that this is, if this were an executory contract, it's been rejected because it was not assumed within 60 days. And we've been through Chapter 7, after all. That has an effect on executory contracts. And as you correctly point out, Your Honor, the only impact of federal bankruptcy law on executory contracts is to make debtors who want to keep them pay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The court will take this.